No mountain captures the popular imagination like Everest, the world's tallest peak, remote, towering out of the Himalayan range. It has frequently proven deadly to those who've tried to reach its summit. The most famous of its victims was the first Englishman, George Mallory. In the early 20s, Mallory took part in the first three expeditions up Everest, dying on his third attempt at the peak. Author Wade Davis's new book, Into the Silence, chronicles those expeditions, but this is not just a book about a mountain. It's a book about a generation, about men who survived the horrors of the First World War. Wade Davis joins us. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Lots has been written about Mallory. He was the leader of the expedition, but there were other people on this expedition that you sort of single out, or you at various points in the course of this book, and one of them was your fellow Canadian, Oliver Wheeler.
Oliver Wheeler. Well, in pursuing the research on Wheeler, I found out that his son was still alive and living in Vancouver, and I went to see him. And in the course of a wonderful afternoon, he pulled off his shelf two volumes of journals that his father had kept in 1921 as he marched across Everest with Mallory. And no one had ever seen these journals.
You say that he is the unsung hero of the expedition. Why? I mean, what
because
was it
he
that
was
he
the
did?
One who found the route to the mountain. It was not George Mallory, as all the historians have claimed. The route to the mountain, you know, these were ridge walkers. They had to get high, and they had to find a way to the summit of the North Col. That was going to be their route to the mountain.
Explain that word, col.
Col means saddle. It just means saddle. These were ridge walkers. They couldn't go up the face of Everest, so they had spotted from the Rongbuk Glacier a col, a saddle, and if they could get to the top of that, they could then get up the northeast shoulder to the northeast ridge, and they thought that that was the route that could get them to the summit. The challenge was, how could they get to the far side of that col, because from the Rongbuk side, it was unclimbable. And so the key in 1921 was finding the route to the col of their desires, and it was Oliver Wheeler who did that. And that, incidentally, is the route that all climbers take to this day who approach the mountain from the Tibet side.
And he found it how?
Because he was a surveyor, and his job was to map the inner core of Everest, and he did so with incredible courage. He spent more time alone on the mountain, exposed to the wrath of the mountain, than anyone else in 1921. And in doing so, he explored all chinks in its armor, as he put it, and he found the route up the East Rongbuk Glacier. And the challenge was, the mouth of the East Rongbuk Glacier was so narrow that Mallory slipped by it three times, thinking it was not worthy of exploration. Wheeler thought everything was worthy of exploration.
Because he was a surveyor, I guess.
He was a mapmaker.
Now, Howard Bury, who was also a member of the expedition, he has written that Wheeler deserves the greatest credit of all of us. So, I mean, if his contemporaries felt that way about him, why has he been so overshadowed by George Mallory?
Well, George Mallory was on all three expeditions. He was extraordinarily charismatic. He was good-looking. And, of course, he died.
So that,
that was a legendary moment in mountaineering history. It was when George Mallory, famously seen going strong for the summit, when the mist rolled in and enveloped his memory in myth.
The other character in this book that is very striking as you read is the First World War. And most of the men who were on this expedition were in that war, and somehow they turned from all that horror to the mountain.
They took their experiences that were never spoken about, yet never forgotten, to the flanks of the mountain. And that's why I was so interested in what was the spirit of the men as they climbed the mountain. My thought always was that death had no mystery for them, because they had seen so much of it. And what mattered was how one lived.
Now, you write about that on page 233. There's a section kind of in the middle of the page that I'd like you to read for us.
But for these men, the war had changed the very gestalt of death. In the trenches, they lived it every moment, some like Wheeler for years. By the time he was 28, he had witnessed the death of hundreds, encountered the shattered bodies of many thousands. Death's power lies in fear, which flourishes in the imagination and the unknown. For Wheeler, there was nothing more that death could show him, short of his own.
And you think that was it? You think they just lost all connection to fear at that point?
I think they were prepared to accept a level of risk that would have been unimaginable before the war.
The other thing that I thought was remarkable about your book was that you describe people who are on this expedition who were grievously wounded in the First World War and were not well when they went up the mountain, and they went anyway.
Oh, absolutely. Jack Hazard climbed to the top of the North Col in 1924 with open bleeding wounds from the Somme beneath his tunic of his climbing gear.
And he just bled all the way up the mountain. Mm-hmm. But he got down the mountain also.
The wounds opened up as he was going up the mountain.
And you also describe a man whose legs were virtually shot off at Gallipoli, and they glued him back together.
Well, nothing could hurt General Bruce. I mean, this is a man whose favorite party trick was to rip a pack of cards in half. He used to put his adjutant on his back and for casual exercise run up and down the Khyber Pass. Mm-hmm. And his legs are virtually severed from his body. And he was 18 months in convalescing with strict orders never to ever attempt to climb stairs or to climb uphill. So instead, he just decided to go to Everest.
Extraordinary. I mean, what kind of men are they?
I mean, one of my favorite is Sandy Wollaston, who on 24-hour notice, the London Times responded to an advertisement for a naturalist. He goes off to Uganda, 3 months to catch up to the expedition, 9 months in the jungle, and when he decides he wants to go home, why go back the same way? He walks from the source of the Congo to the mouth. I mean, Howard Bury once anointed his body with scented oils and just naked walked down the Ganges and was famous for having killed a man-eating tiger that had run off and eaten 21 holy men. You know, these were just incredible men. You know, the grit, the strength of character. You know, and these were men who just didn't know that there were limits to what a man could do.
Wade Davis is a National Geographic explorer in residence. He's the author of many books, but this latest one is Into the Silence: The Great War, Mallory, and the Conquest of Everest. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And let's talk next about the largest freestanding mountain on the planet. Kilimanjaro is a dormant volcano, not part of a mountain range like Everest, and it soars more than 19,000 feet. A pitcher from the New York Mets is planning to climb it. R.A. Dickey is leading a trip to the top to raise money and awareness for a group that assists victims of sex trafficking in India. Now, Kilimanjaro in Africa is not considered the hardest climb in the world, but Mets management is not too excited. That Mr. Dickey is going. The team can't prevent him from climbing, but they've sent the pitcher a letter reminding him that if he gets injured, the Mets could void the rest of his multi-million-dollar contract. Quote, "It's not like it's Everest."
The 1940s Los Angeles was a gritty place, but it was also one of undeniable beauty and diversity. Author Hector Tobar might not have experienced it himself, but he recommends a book that will let you do just that. He has this essay for our series, You Must Read This.
People think of Los Angeles as a city without a past, but as a native Angeleno, I stumble upon the relics of its history all the time. The rails of our long-ago vanished streetcars embedded in the asphalt, for example. There are many novels that can give their readers a sense of what it was like to live in that old L.A. It's a city of men in fedoras and women in broad-shouldered dresses. But it's John Fante, largely forgotten outside Los Angeles, who best brings the passion, the possibility, and the hurt of that glamorous city to life, and specifically his 1939 novel, Ask the Dust. Ask the Dust is the story of Fante's alter ego, Arturo Bandini. Like Fante himself, Bandini has come to L.A. from Colorado during the Great Depression. His dream is to be a great writer, but his so far minuscule royalty checks allow him nothing better than a room in Bunker Hill, a neighborhood of worn-out apartments and sagging Victorian mansions overlooking downtown. Fante populates Ask the Dust with people who've come from the colder corners of the U.S. The bright daylight that makes the California palm trees grow tall unsettles them. Many are drifting, lost Midwesterners searching for wealth and happiness. And they've arrived in L.A., as Fante writes, with the dust of Chicago and Cincinnati and Cleveland on their shoes, doomed to die in the sun. As Bandini toils away in his hotel room writing short stories, he daydreams about Camila Lopez, a Mexican-American waitress at his local bar. She soon becomes the mysterious, tragic presence at the center of Ask the Dust. Their romance is angry and conflicted. They fight on the beach and on Wilshire Boulevard, where Camila teases Bandini and scandalizes passers-by with a flash of her bare legs. When Bandini taunts her with ethnic slurs, she shoots back that she's just as American as he is. Bandini's obsession with Camila carries him across the LA landscape, and as I read their love story, I see a city that's familiar to me. It's a place where people are slowly realizing that paradise can be a very unhappy destination indeed. It's a multi-ethnic city, too, with Filipinos and Japanese kids playing football and Jewish refugees and scenes inside L.A.'s Black Belt. It's an L.A. that's glitzy and polished and sexy, but also desolate and lonely. Today, more than 70 years later, Fonte's old Bunker Hill neighborhood is gone. But now, as then, Americans are on the move again, uprooted by hard times. They're seeking better lives in other booming Sunbelt cities. It's an old American story. We seek, we suffer, we carry our ambitions and our obsessions to new places. And it's a story told with great verve and heart in John Fonte's unforgettable novel, Ask the Dust.
Hector Tobar is a journalist and novelist. His most recent book is The Barbarian Nurseries. For lovers of crime thrillers, movies with creepy plots, low lighting, and suspenseful music, we have a different way to get your fix. Author Dwayne Swierczynski likes his crime stories splayed across the page in comic book form. He recommends three books that take you beyond the police tape. It's for our series, Three Books, in which we ask authors to recommend books on one theme.
I'm pretty much a snob when it comes to true crime stories. I want something vivid. But I also don't want 8 pages of shocking photos or a garish cover with a mugshot of some dude who needs a sandwich, a shave, and a hug. I want my tales of real-life mayhem to be well-researched and with the weight of history behind them, but also move with the speed of an action film. Which is why I love it when true crime stories are told in graphic novel form. Here are three of my favorites. Elliot, Untouchable Ness, famously tangled with one of history's greatest villains, Alphonse Scarface Capone. And then he went off to Cleveland and ended up hunting someone even worse, that city's notorious Torso Killer. In Torso, Brian Michael Bendis and Mark Andreyko make stunning use of newspaper clippings, crime scene snaps, and period photography, making Torso seem less a traditional comic book and more like a great flick that somehow ended up on paper instead of celluloid. And while the creators supply their own best guess ending, the killer was never caught. You can tell they breathed in endless gallons of microfiche copier ink to absorb every grisly little detail. For a decade now, Rick Geary has been serving up delightfully grisly novels, tackling such infamous cases as the Lizzie Borden murders, Jack the Ripper, and the Lindbergh baby kidnapping. But my favorite is The Terrible Axe Man of New Orleans, about a now obscure maniac who roamed the streets of 1918 New Orleans and like to chop up his sleeping victims with a you-know-what. Geary walks us through each murder in spare, sober detail, and saves a nasty little jazz-fueled twist, which I refuse to ruin for you, right in the middle of the book. This killer's identity was never revealed, and the puzzling questions Geary asks at the conclusion will chill you as much as the gory murders. Is it strange to call a graphic novel about a vicious psychopath both gruesome and heartwarming? Jeff Jensen's The Green River Killer also happens to be a tender meditation on his own father, Detective Tom Jensen, who led the 1982 task force charged with taking down the man suspected of killing at least 48 women. But this is not a whodunit. Early on in the book, Jensen has a suspect in custody. I never thought I'd say this about a serial killer story, but I finished it feeling both gutted and uplifted. With true crime in comics, the old cliche is true. A single image can be more expressive than 1,000 words of prose. It almost makes me wish that writers would bring along an artist the next time they step into a blood-splattered crime scene or a dusty newspaper morgue.
Dwayne Swierczynski is the author of the novel Hell and Gone. You can comment on his essay at our website. Go to nprbooks.org.
$2,000 for the electricity bill. Wow. Well, it's probably fair to say that Bill Cosby does not go out of his way to hang elaborate Christmas decorations from his house in western Massachusetts. But every Christmas, his three young grandchildren come for a visit. And last year, Cosby used his connections to get a personal phone call from some of Santa's helpers. He writes about what happened in his new book. It's called I Didn't Ask to Be Born, But I'm Glad I Was. And when I spoke with Cosby this past week, I asked him to describe what his grandkids are like.
They're annoying. I am not the kind of grandfather who really believes that they came from heaven above. I mean, these people make a lot of noise. They blame each other for things. They take turns. It's almost like, okay, 1, 2, 3, and you go in that order, screaming and yelling.
One is age 7.
Seven, and then 2 were 8.
8, okay. So this is a cold Christmas Eve. The kids are not behaving. So you come up with this ingenious plan to get them to cooperate and behave. And the phone rings. And who's on the phone?
It was an assistant to Mr. and Mrs. Claus. And the assistant found that the three grandchildren were not where they're supposed to be. And she had these letters with the requests for presents and the names, and she was checking to see if these were the presents for these children, if these were the children. She called in on my phone, and at first I thought it was Rita Moreno, but it wasn't. It was the assistant
to Santa Claus.
Yeah, and said, are they there? So I said, yes, just a minute. So I walked into the den of iniquity and yelling. And I said to them, there's an assistant of Santa Claus's on the phone who wants to talk to you guys. And automatically, man,
that's it.
They turned around and looked at me. And I said, come on. And they walked. They looked, reminded me of the Ritz brothers. It was three brothers, a comedy team, and they were stuck together. And they were walking, and came, and I put the assistant on the speakerphone, and the assistant went up and down the list.
The children, of course, I'm assuming, were declaring how good they'd been throughout the year.
Like pro quarterbacks who are taught, you know, forget that last interception.
Now, Miss Jones, who was Santa's assistant, she actually, at a certain point, she tells the kids that she's getting another call and that there's somebody else on the line.
Is Skylar.
And Skylar is?
Santa doesn't know where he's going. You know, in the day of computers and things like that, the kids are not where they're supposed to be. Skylar's job is to make the corrections.
Skylar is basically Santa's navigator.
Exactly. And Skylar asked where they were. So we're at Grandpappy and Grandmommy's house. Well, where are they? They really couldn't say because they're always brought to the house.
They didn't know where they were. I mean, they knew they were in Massachusetts.
Yeah, but they couldn't tell anybody how to get there. One description was, well, you get off the plane, then you get in the car, and then when you wake up, you'll be in Greenfield. And he told them he could see them if they went outside and pointed to a certain star.
So you send all three grandchildren outside?
No, I did not.
You didn't? I see. Okay.
No, please. We're on the radio. I don't want people to think Bill Cosby sent his grandchildren
I see.
Out.
Forgive me. Santa's navigator.
It was about 30 degrees below zero. So, but see, these greedy children, that's who we can blame it on. The greed of little children said, okay, go outside. And they were pointing, and all three of them pointed in different directions. And then all I heard Skylar was saying on the phone, which was a speaker, okay, I have it. I know where they are now. So they were called back in.
They came back in, and there was one more phone call. Phone rings again. This is an important call.
This is from an assistant who is, and I didn't know, anything about this was Santa's dietitian.
See.
So I said, just a minute, and I put it to the speaker, and I went back to the den of iniquity and yelling and screaming, which they were doing again. And I said, there's another assistant, so here they come. And he, in fact, said to them, please do not leave any cookies or milk.
Wow.
For Santa, because his cholesterol and the triglycerides way up there, which one can see and on pictures of him.
He cannot actually eat the cookies and drink the milk.
No. You could leave out maybe some soy milk.
Oh.
But not 2% plain. No silk.
No silk.
No silk. No chocolate flavored. You know, none of that stuff. Just water.
Or plain soy milk.
Please.
Are the grandkids coming for Christmas this year? Are they with you this year?
They will be here.
So are you planning to arrange for some phone calls for them this year?
I don't think they're going to go for it.
Uh-oh.
This time.
That's Bill Cosby. His new book is called I Didn't Ask to Be Born, But I'm Glad I Was. Bill Cosby, thank you so much, and Merry Christmas to you.
And to all grandparents who smile because they see a grandchild.
The New Testament is constantly reinterpreted from a variety of perspectives. Feminists, socialists, traditionalists, there's even a version as seen through the prism of Star Wars. Well, add to the collection the Jewish annotated